Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, this is Deborah Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the first week of December. This week, we are very pleased to have Tom Betts as our guest, here to speak with us about bats of the Olympic Peninsula. Tom is a recently retired wildlife biologist who spent much of his career studying bats, and we have long wanted to pick his brain about these fascinating creatures. Welcome, Tom.
Hi, glad to be here.
We are happy to have you. But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. Isn't this an interesting sound? We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is.
The most notable event of this past week is a dramatic change in the weather, with our first locally significant drop in temperature, along with the first major snowfall recorded in the mountains. Crystal Mountain and Stevens Pass both reported 18 to 24 inches of snow over the weekend, with more forecast off and on through the week. Closer to home in the Olympics, they're predicting total snow accumulations near Hurricane Ridge of about 6 to 7 inches through Monday, with more snow also predicted midweek. Local skiers and snowboarders are rejoicing.
Yahoo! With colder weather here, it makes us wonder how other animals cope with it, especially animals as tiny as hummingbirds. Anna's hummingbird is the only hummingbird that stays through the winter in our area, but this has not always been so. Their range has expanded steadily northward as seasonal temperatures have become milder and as food has become more readily available in the form of backyard hummingbird feeders. Many small birds survive through the cold winter nights by roosting together in protected areas, but hummingbirds are able to dramatically lower their body temperature and go into a kind of deep sleep or daily torpor. During periods of torpor, their body temperature can drop up to 50 degrees, and they consume about 50 times less energy than when they're awake.
We should have a couple of cold, clear nights this week, an excellent time for you to check out four of our five brightest planets. Venus, the brightest planet, is the dominant object in our western sky right at dusk, while Jupiter, the second brightest, is the dominant in the eastern sky just before sunrise. Mars joins Venus in the mid to late evening, but it is higher up in the sky and sets in the west after Venus does. The elusive planet Mercury will also be visible at nightfall and best seen around December 10th. For other great tips on night sky viewing, go to earthsky.org.
And there is more good news for the return of our fishers to Washington State. As most of you know by now, fishers are the second largest member of our weasel family, second only to wolverines, whose population was driven to extinction in the mid-1900s by hunters after their luxurious pelts, along with habitat fragmentation. The first effort to successfully reintroduce them in Washington was carried out at the Olympic National Park, right in our backyard, and this happened from 2008 to 2010. And now the effort is being expanded to Mount Rainier National Park. 10 fishers were released last Friday, the first of 40 planned for reintroduction there this winter. We wish them every success in their new home. I've always been fascinated by bats, and I was very excited last summer at the prospect of going out on an evening bat walk, sponsored by Admiralty Audubon and led by bat biologist Tom Betts. I wasn't able to make it to that walk, so I figured that the next best thing was to get Tom in to speak with us on the radio about these fascinating flying mammals. They are our only flying mammal, right? I mean, flying squirrels don't really count because they glide more than fly.
That's right. They are our most truly flying mammal. There are several mammals that glide, actually, including flying squirrels. But bats are capable of true flight, just like birds.
So people used to think of them as flying mice, but it turns out that they're more closely related to shrews and primates than to rodents, right?
Well, bats go back actually 50 or 60 million years. They look very similar to what they look like today. The origin and evolution of bats is still a little bit confusing. There was a time when We thought that bats actually were very closely related to shrews and primates based on anatomy and physiology. But with more recent DNA testing, that's actually put into question. And now, in fact, they seem more closely related perhaps to even-toed animals like deer and elk, and also, believe it or not, to cetaceans. So can you imagine a bat related to a whale?
Oh, that's amazing. You were telling me earlier how bats are generally grouped into two major categories.
Yes, they're actually what we call the megachiropterans and the microchiropterans. That would suggest that megachiropterans are big, and for the most part they are, whereas microchiropterans, which includes all of the species we have in North America, actually in the Western Hemisphere, are microchiropterans, but some of those are pretty big too. So it's a little bit confusing, but that's the way it is.
So what are the major differences between those two groups?
Microchiropterans hunt using echolocation. They make a sonar call, and they find their way through the forest and in caves and everything through sound, whereas most megachiropterans that we might be familiar with are called flying foxes, and they're very common in Africa. They're common in the Pacific Islands, and they look more or less like a fox. So they have really big eyes and really big ears and a big nose, and they find their way and their food through sight and through smell. They hunt for fruit rather than insects.
I got a close view of one in Africa, and it was really beautiful. I mean, it really truly did look like a flying fox, and they're large. I mean, the wingspan of some of those can reach several feet, right?
The biggest ones actually are almost the size of a Canada goose, and some of them that I worked with in Africa, maybe the body size is about like a Siamese cat, definitely bigger than a raven.
Wow, that's amazing. And then there's a bumblebee bat that's tiny.
The bumblebee bat is very, very tiny. We even have bats here, and we'll talk about it a little more in a minute. But some of our bats right here in the Olympic Peninsula only weigh about what a nickel weighs.
Wow.
5 grams.
You were talking about that the largest bats don't echolocate, that they find their prey by smell. And, you know, we have this phrase, blind as a bat, but it turns out that that's really incorrect.
That's right. It's a common misperception, especially with the micro bats. I'll call them the small bats right now, or I might just call them bats. Bats can see just fine. Even the ones that we have around here see just fine. It's just that they also can find their way in the dark, and they normally feed in the dark, and their activities in the dark, so they use their sonar or echolocation rather than their sight.
What do the big bats eat versus the small ones?
There's kind of two different ways to think about big when it comes to the bats. The big bats, like the megachiropterans, are basically fruit bats. You'll also find pollinators in that group, etc. Whereas the small micro bats, at least in our area, feed on insects, essentially exclusively. However, between those, we have big bats here, bigger bats, far bigger bats like the hoary bat. We'll talk about those again in a minute. Versus our smallest bat like the California bat. The biggest bats usually are hunting bigger targets, bigger prey. So they're looking for big moths, whereas the really small bats are looking for gnats and mosquitoes.
Well, and for some reason, bats have gotten this bad rep, and people are afraid of them, and they are such cool and useful creatures. I mean, they eat literally tons of insect pests and are great pollinators and seed dispersers also, right?
That's correct. In our latitude, in most of the United States, especially the further north ones, they're all insect eaters. But once you start getting closer to, let's say, Texas, California, Arizona, and then closer into the tropics, we start finding pollinators. We start finding fruit-eating bats, and they disperse seeds. Some studies have shown that bats are very, very important in keeping tropical rainforests going, basically. If an area is clear-cut, it reestablishes through droppings of bats, basically, dispersing seeds.
Back to how much they can eat. I mean, they can eat like their weight in mosquitoes, right?
Well, that's the one that's eat mosquitoes, yeah, the small ones. But yes, thousands and thousands of insects. I don't remember figures very well, but at least as far as tons of insects. But there are some caves in, let's say, Texas. We've heard of Carlsbad Caverns. You may have heard of the Austin Congress Street Bridge in
Actually,
Austin.
I've been there to see them, and it was like a big party. I mean, people watching the bats. And it was so cool. I mean, kids and older folks, people of every description, they're poised to see the bats come out and just hundreds of thousands of bats pouring out from underneath this bridge.
It is an event. And believe it or not, the city of Austin at one time thought they were pests and they were going to eliminate them. And then the founder of Bat Conservation International, Merwin Tuttle, said, no, these could be a tourist attraction. And now they're probably the biggest tourist attraction in Texas. There's 2 million bats that use that bridge.
Wow.
There's a cave down near San Antonio that is now owned by or managed by Bat Conservation International that has 20 million bats in it. And those go out every night. They leave for hours on end. And they spread out over perhaps a 50-mile radius. And in one night, that number of bats, I don't remember, but it's tons of insects that they consume every night.
Wow. All of our bats here on the Olympic Peninsula are insectivores, and they use echolocation to communicate and find their prey, right? Would you describe a bit about how this works and how they actually catch their prey?
On the Olympic Peninsula and in Washington State in general, they are all insectivores, and they all do use echolocation. That's basically a sonar. They use their throat, they use their mouth, and they emit a very, very high-frequency call and a very short duration call. That goes out, and it bounces off of objects. And that may be a tree, it might be a bush, it might be a human being, or it might be an insect. And they find their way through that. So they're using it to locate where they are in space. They're also using it to locate their prey, insects in this case. And when they find it, then they will zoom in on that target. So I call it a target, but it's an insect.
You were describing how ticking picks up the closer they get to their target species.
Right. When they're going out, they leave their roost. A roost is where they spend the night. When they leave that, they're generally not hunting. In fact, the first thing they do is they go out to a source of water. So when they're calling, they're kind of on cruise control, and you might say their call goes tick, 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 tick. That's when we're studying them. That's when we catch them, because they're not paying attention very well. So we put up nets, and we can catch them sometimes, because they're not paying attention. Once they get their drink of water, then they go out hunting, and that call speeds up, tick, 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 and they're looking around for a target. As they find it, they zoom in on that, and that call will speed up. Because they're getting closer, they need more information. As they approach it very close, it actually speeds up to where we hear it as a bzzz. And then when they catch it, they quit their call. And they actually catch that insect often in their mouth, but they can also use their wing to wrap around and pull it in like if they had a baseball glove. Or they can use their membrane on their tail and scoop it up, and then they grab that, eat it, and then start off.
And it ends up being, if you looked in slow motion, it ends up being like a gymnastic roll a lot of times, where they scoop it up like lacrosse and they kind of somersault over and catch it in their mouths and carry on.
Yes, it's true. And they're very, very agile. They can do this, I think, in very what we call cluttered environments, trees, etc. I've seen some studies in laboratories where they release bats and they can have strings hanging down about 1 inch apart, and that battle approached that and turned sideways and flying sideways through 1 inch and then flip back up and keep flying without disturbing the strings.
So different species have different calls, just like birds do, but since they're usually so far out of our hearing range, we don't pick up on that.
That's right. Our hearing range, even if you're very, very young, it doesn't ever go over about 20,000 hertz. That's a measurement of sound frequency. Most of us, like my highest right now is about 10 kilohertz. A bat, our lowest frequencies are in the 20s and go up to 100 kilohertz. So far higher than we can hear with our ears. So we use electronic equipment to pick those calls up and lower them down to where we can hear them.
So how many species of bats do we have in Washington State and here on the Olympic Peninsula?
Right now, actually, there are 15 or so species in Washington and about 11 species on the Olympics. But that compares to 100 species in the United States and 1,200 or so species in the entire world. So a very large family, the second largest family of mammals in the world compared, rodents are the only larger.
A lot of people don't realize that they're such a large group.
There's about 5,000 total mammal species in the world. So bats amount to about one quarter of all of the mammal species in the world. But most of those are in the tropics. In Costa Rica, there are about 800 species, whereas in the entire United States, there's about 100, and there are about 11 in our neighborhood.
Well, will you please introduce us to our different species, going from those that we'd most often encounter and with those that are most rare?
Sure. The most common ones that we would find right in our particular area are, the hoary bat is our largest bat and also the most widely distributed bat.
They're widely distributed, but they're not that common, are they? Or are they?
Relatively common, I think, yes. And they're the only bat found in Hawaii. We have two species, the hoary bat and the silver-haired bat, that actually roost in trees and not in caves, barns, things like that. They roost in trees, and they also migrate far to the south. They don't hang out around here. And then we have smaller species, far smaller species. Our smallest species around here, which is also fairly common, is the California bat. There's also a Yuma bat. I did some work out at Crescent Lake with the Park Service this last summer, and we found Yuma bats were abundant there. We also have little brown bats, big brown bats, basically seven species of bats that are all in the genus Myotis, which is a little mouse-eared bat is what they're called, and then four other species that are almost all bigger. Two that are very rare, one would be the Keen's Myotis, which is quite rare and only found along the British Columbia coast and into the Olympic Peninsula on the coast in cedar groves and forests. And then we have Townsend's big-eared bats, which are about the coolest bat that I know.
Oh, well, I'd love to see one of those. And sadly, we have run out of time for this week, but luckily, you can tune in to part two of this fascinating topic next month. Thanks so much for joining us, Tom.
Glad to be here. Thanks for asking me.
We have a ton of upcoming natural history events to tell you about. It starts on Thursday, December 8th, and there's a free showing of the film Sonic Sea up at the Dungeness River Audubon Center in Squim. This is an important film that focuses on the increasing problem of noise pollution in our oceans.
Come learn about the many benefits and uses of native plants at the Jefferson County Conservation District's Native Plant Workshop. It's free and open to the public and being held from 9 to noon on Friday, December 9th at the Chimicum Grange. Go to jeffersoncd.org for details.
Our local chapter of the Washington Native Plant Society is also taking a hike up the lower Big Quilcene Trail on Friday. Meet at the ranger station at Quilcene at 9 a.m., but be aware that the hike is weather-dependent. Check with Sharon at eschlentner@olipin.com for details.
It's time to start thinking about Audubon Society's annual Christmas bird count. There are several counts happening later in the month that we will keep you posted on. But meanwhile, Olympic Peninsula Audubon up in Squim is hosting a pre-count all day on Saturday, December 10th. To help you get ready for the big event, go to olympicpeninsulaaudubon.org for more details.
Then on Sunday, December 11th, join the Port Townsend Marine Science Center at 3 p.m. at the Fort Warden Chapel for a lecture titled Citizen Science, Searching for Heroes and Hope, which is certainly timely. Go to ptmsc.org for more information. And here's our mystery sound again.
That was a little brown bat, one of our local species that we find in the Olympic Peninsula quite commonly. Now, that bat actually has a call far higher than we can hear with our ears, our human capabilities. So we have special equipment that records that and lowers it down to where we can hear it. What you're hearing here is the search phase of a bat, a little brown bat, as he's hunting. So it sounds like a tickety, tickety, tickety. He's looking around. And then he zooms in on something when he finds it. And then you'll hear that bzzz. That's called a feeding buzz. And that's when his call speeds up so fast that it sounds to us just like a continuous call. And then it stops. And that's when he captured his prey, he or she, and is eating it while tumbling through space, believe it or not. And then that call will start again, tick, tick, tick. That means he's swallowed his prey and he's off hunting again.
Thanks so much for that. And that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the first week of December. And thanks so much for joining me, Tom, and thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 11:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. Happy trails!
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra and Seiji Ozawa performing the Fledermaus Overture.